rather wonderful about life on Earth. In fact, if you take the longest possible perspective, now looking back about 4 billion years, you will find that every life form on Earth is related to every other. We all share common ancestors because all life came from the first self-reproducing single-celled organism that existed in the oceans of primal Earth. Yes, that tree outside is your relative, as is every bug and blade of grass. Invite them in for dinner, why don't you? This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from Kevin Hunt in anthropology. I'm Don Glass.
Next time on The World from PRI, China is more than the host of this summer's Olympic Games. It's also a competitor pushing to win the most gold medals. That's a new kind of mindset for Chinese athletes. The focus used to be on grace and agility. China flexing its muscles. That story in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock. In sports news, the Pittsburgh Steelers have signed their first-round draft pick, running back Rashard Mendenhall, to a 5-year contract. Mendenhall, the number 23 overall pick, played at Illinois. He's expected to return kicks and perhaps spell Willie Parker, who's returning from a broken leg. Brett Favre has told the Green Bay Packers he plans to report to training camp this weekend, according to an NFL Network report today, a move perhaps designed to force the team to quickly work out a trade for the 3-time MVP. The team committed to moving on with Aaron Rodgers after Favre retired early in March, led them to believe he was coming back in late March, then decided to stay retired until he apparently changed his mind once again. Members of the Chicago Bears say they're happy to see return star Devin Hester at training camp. Hester skipped the Bears' first practices this week in a holdout, but was back at camp today. There's no word on whether he's signed a new contract. Indianapolis opened its first training camp since 1998 without Peyton Manning. The Colts star quarterback is back in Indianapolis recovering from surgery to remove an infected bursa sac from his left knee. On the plus side, Marvin Harrison walked onto the field to cheers. An injured left knee kept him out of action for most of last season, but he returned for the playoff loss to San Diego. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the final Krannert Uncorked for the season on July 31st in the Krannert Center lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
It's 2:43. We have a follow-up today on the mine disaster that killed 9 people last summer. The owners of that Utah mine have been fined more than $1.6 million for safety violations. It's the largest fine ever against a coal company. The Mine Safety and Health Administration issued a scathing report against Murray Energy. The report says that company displayed a high level of negligence and acted with reckless disregard. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
All along, Murray Energy insisted the tragedy at the Crandall Canyon mine was caused by an earthquake, not mining activity. Seismologists doubted that. MSHA head Richard Stickler settled the issue.
It was not, and I'll repeat, not, it was not a natural occurring earthquake.
6 miners died in the initial collapse. 10 days later, 3 rescuers were killed in a subsequent one. The report essentially says the company removed too much coal from the wrong places, causing the mine to collapse. In deep underground coal mines like those often found in the West, not all the coal can be removed. Some has to be left to support all that rock above. Richard Gates is MSHA's lead investigator for the Crandall Canyon incidents.
It's a pretty basic concept that you need to have something, a coal pillar or a barrier pillar left in place of sufficient size and strength to support the overburden above it.
At Crandall Canyon, that overburden was about 2,000 feet of rock. MSHA says Murray Energy had 3 warnings that something was wrong. Twice in March and once just 3 days before the collapse, the mine experienced seismic events that caused coal to burst out from the walls. These were mini versions of the huge collapse that occurred August 6th. Murray's engineering firm, Agapito Associates, also was fined $220,000 for telling Murray its mining plan was safe when it wasn't. IMSHA itself was criticized in a second report released Thursday by the Department of Labor. It said IMSHA failed to properly oversee the company's mining plan and that it bungled the rescue operation. IMSHA officials met with the victims' families for more than 5 hours prior to releasing their report. The families didn't want to talk with reporters, but one of their attorneys, Alan Mortensen, said they expressed little emotion during the presentation.
There was a moment of silence at the beginning, and that was the most emotional time, was the moment of silence, as all the lost ones were remembered.
In a written statement, Murray Energy called the IMSHA report incomplete because it doesn't have input from the company's own mine experts. That's because they've exercised their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Here's Murray attorney Kevin Anderson reading from the company's statement.
Regrettably, this report does not have the benefit of all of the facts and appears to have been tainted, in part, by 10 months of relentless political clamoring to lay blame for these tragic events.
Anderson was referring to investigations launched by members of Congress. While his clients now must pay more than $1.6 million in fines, they also face another, perhaps more serious, judgment. IMSHA will give its report to a U.S. attorney who will decide whether to press criminal charges against those responsible for the Crandall Canyon mine disaster. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Price, Utah.
The country's two radio satellite companies are now almost one. Four out of five commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission have voted on this merger already. Two were for it, two were against it. And now the last regulator has signaled her approval of bringing Sirius and XM together. NPR's Felix Contreras has more.
Commissioner Deborah Taylor Tate is the last to vote. FCC observers say she is leaning toward approval, but only after the two companies agree to price caps on subscriptions, commit to manufacturing radios that receive both XM and Sirius signals, and agree to set aside channels for educational programming and programming for minorities and women. The companies also agreed to pay more than $19 million in fines for longstanding violations of FCC regulations concerning radio signal interference. The proposed merger came to the FCC more than a year ago after shareholders for both companies voted to consolidate. Neither XM nor Sirius had managed to sign up enough subscribers to cover their operating costs. The FCC granted separate licenses for broadcast spectrum space to the companies in 1997. XM went on the air in 2001, followed by Sirius a year later. Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, who voted against the deal, says a combined company would control an enormous amount of the public airwaves.
They're going to have more spectrum than the AM and FM bands combined. It's an enormous amount of market power to be concentrating in one company without ensuring there's adequate protections for consumers.
The Department of Justice cleared the merger in March, drawing protests from consumer advocates, broadcasters, and National Public Radio. NPR has two channels on Sirius Satellite Radio, and it has opposed the merger on the grounds it would create a monopoly satellite radio provider. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
Naked ladies, rabbits, and some basketballs are on display at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art, courtesy of American painter, sculptor, and artist provocateur Jeff Koons. At age 53, Koons is one of the most popular artists of his generation. His shiny blue heart sold for over $23 million not long ago. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg says visitors to the show in Chicago were either smiling, laughing, or puzzled.
A smiler was Andrew Vasilinovich of Chicago.
I love Jeff Koons. He's a lot of fun. I like artists that encourage a positive outlook on the world.
Among the puzzled was Will Barget of Near Cincinnati. Will, age 12, was standing in front of Jeff Koons' three-ball total equilibrium tank. Three Spalding basketballs suspended in distilled water in a rectangular glass box.
They're just floating. It's strange. All they used was like a fish tank and a ball.
Koons made the piece in 1985, part of a series. One ball, two balls, three balls.
It's just strange.
Well, it is, but it got your attention, which is very Jeff Koons. He's like the big psst of contemporary art. More about the basketballs later, but first, as we say in radio, Little Jeff and the Light Box. A lit-up, blown-up photograph of a small boy with his Crayola set.
He's probably about 7, maybe.
And look at that sweet face. He's got his hair is so carefully combed, and he has this nice little smile at whoever's taking the picture.
Yeah, it's a perfect photo of Jeff as an artist, the portrait of an artist as a young boy.
Tricia Van Eck is a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art. She helped guest curator Francesco Bonomi and Koons himself to put this show together.
And it's typical of everything that Jeff does. He changes the context. Everything that he does is some kind of magic that he spins on the work.
In this case, he takes an old snapshot his grandma may have carried around in her wallet, enlarges it, backlights it, and puts it in this exhibition. The message?
Here's my work. Yeah, ta-da. And ta-da is a huge thing for Jeff.
Tricia tells a nice story about Koons and ta-da.
Jeff came home one day and his son was drawing, just like he was drawing in that photograph, and his son said, ta-da! And Jeff said, ta-da, that's what I work all week in the studio to capture. Ta-da!
Koons' big, shiny blue heart is a ta-da. So is the big, shiny balloon dog, a stainless steel dachshund that weighs more than a ton, but looks like those air-filled long balloons that guys at zoos twist into animals.
It's orange, it's monumental, you can see yourself.
And you smile, just smile, no message.
It is what it is. It's shiny, it's big, it's perfect, it's taking objects that we're all familiar with and making them larger than life.
There's a shiny silver rabbit in the Chicago show, a shiny red lobster, and various brand new Hoover vacuum shampoo polishers in big acrylic cases. And then, behind a sturdy concealing wall, some larger than billboard size works we cannot show you at NPR.org because they're Jeff Koons and his once wife, Cicciolina, the former soft porn star and Italian parliamentarian, making, shall we say, whoopee, or making babies, or making, hey, I don't know what to call it, but that sweet little lightbox boy sure grew up. Is this art?
Jeff would say that everything he does is art, and Jeff has always tried to cross boundaries of what is art and what is not, what is high art, what is low art, what is commercial products, what is fine art.
And while we're on the subject of is this art, back to the basketballs.
Listen, what do you say to people who will say to you, those are really fancy theories, but the guy took 2 basketballs, stuck them in a case with some water, and
okay,
here
well,
they are in a museum.
That's probably the one where you say, okay, but how is it floating?
No, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say,
like
the guy took 2 basketballs and he put them in a case with water.
And they're just floating. Then how do you explain this one that's
no,
just...
No, it's not what I'm asking.
Oh.
What are they doing in a museum?
Well, again, it's that... It's 2 basketballs. It's in what you're calling a fish tank, a display cabinet. It's...
This is not easy, is it? But the thing that occurs to me as you struggle to find an explanation for this, a simple explanation, mm-hmm. is there are ordinary things that an artist has taken and done something to that makes us look at them anew.
Right, exactly. And that is the key to his work. It's looking at what's already out there in the world, subtly twisting it, sometimes majorly twisting it, and re-presenting it and saying what you like as a person, you like basketballs, they're here. Why shouldn't basketballs be art?
In a lecture at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, Jeff Koons put it this way.
For me, art starts with self-acceptance, with self-trust. Whatever you come to with art, it's perfect. You don't have to come with anything. What you bring to something is the art. That's where it's found. It's found within you.
Jeff Koons has his critics, of course. One of them is Robert Hughes, erstwhile art critic for Time magazine. On NPR once, Hughes had this evaluation of Mr. Koons.
You know, he's one of those guys who would have been, you know, brilliant at selling swamp in Florida or raising money for the excavation of entirely fictional gold mines in Nevada.
Chicago curator Tricia Van Eck agrees that Koons has a talent for selling things, plus a savvy sense of the art market. But she says Koons also has a deep appreciation of art history, aesthetics, and the creative process. So the heck with criticism from the experts.
He's not interested in that critical dialogue. He's looking around, what do people like? I'm going to show them that. I'm going to give them that. And critics don't like that.
But the people do. Those crowds at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago were mostly smiling. The show is there and there only until September 21st. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
For images of the exhibition at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art, visit NPR's website, npr.org.
Earth and Sky.
Friday, July 25th, 2008, the annual Delta Aquarid meteor shower rambles along steadily at this time of year.
The shower isn't known for exhibiting a sharp peak, but it might be expected to produce the most meteors between midnight and dawn this weekend. That might be the case, if not for the moon.
The moon is up after midnight now. It's bright enough to wash some Delta Aquarid meteors from view. And yet this time of year is known as peak meteor season for us in the Northern Hemisphere. Nights are warm, and the Delta Aquarid shower combines with the famous August Perseid meteor shower to create the year's best meteor displays.
So, here's your late July, early August meteor strategy for 2008. Wait. That's right. Wait until the moon is out of the way. By the last day or two of July, say around midweek in the coming week, the waning moon will be rising so near dawn that you'll have a window for dark sky meteor watching just after midnight.
Or wait until next weekend, the mornings of August 2nd or 3rd, when the moon will be gone and the Perseid meteor shower will begin rising to its peak. That peak will come on the morning of Tuesday, August 12th. Then the moon will be up in the evening, but out of the way after midnight, when the most meteors will be flying. I'm Deborah Byrd.
And I'm Joel Block for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana; and First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign-Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
If you recycle, you may have noticed it's gotten easier. No more separating plastic from glass. No more cutting up the cardboard.
Cereal boxes in here.
Cereal boxes.
Could I put it in with the newspapers, too?
Yes, exactly.
Same thing with
exactly.
The newspapers.
Exactly. Everything goes together anymore.
We sort through the latest changes in how we recycle later today on All Things Considered. From